Good morning and welcome to The Bridge, a weekly news magazine produced by Coast Community Radio. I'm David Paul. In this week's edition, Amanda Peacher reports on the impact of one of Crook County, Oregon's largest employers shutting down. We'll hear about opposition to the Coquille tribe building a casino in South Medford in the Rogue Valley. Jessica Robinson will tell us how Idaho is trying to lure teachers to the state. Patricia Murphy looks at the first submarine to allow enlisted women to serve on board. Some Northwest ski resorts are thinking about using snowmaking machines due to the lack of snow. We'll hear from a Northwest ER nurse who went to Liberia to treat Ebola patients. And it was the last voyage of the fabled Puget Sound ferry Kalakala. All that on this week's edition of The Bridge. But first, these news headlines. Last November, the wood grain mill shut down most of its operation in Prineville, Oregon, and laid off nearly 200 mill workers after the mill's roof collapsed. The mill was one of the largest employers in Crook County. Now, both the community and laid-off workers are struggling to recover. For many mill employees, the layoffs meant not only the loss of a paycheck, but also a lost community. Amanda Peacher reports.
A small group of women gather around Mary Stanislow's kitchen table in Powell Butte, just outside of Prineville.
There is soda in there if you guys want soda.
No. You know that's not how we roll, Mary.
These women used to work together. They saw each other every day at the wood grain mill. But that changed when they lost their jobs.
But this is probably like the worst breakup I've ever, you know, it's a divorce. Feeling type sinking. It's devastation, really.
Peggy Murphy worked at Wood Grain for 20 years. 2 months ago, she and her coworkers lost their jobs.
You wake up anxious at 3 o'clock in the morning because you don't know what you're gonna do. What are you gonna do? How can you feed your kids? You know, it sucks.
Wood Grain managers announced the closure of most mill operations right before Thanksgiving, after a huge section of the mill's roof collapsed under the weight of snow.
When they laid us off, they told, you know, today's your last day. They gave me an hour's notice and said, you no longer have insurance.
Wood Grain officials declined a recorded interview with OPB. But in an email, company vice president Greg Easton said, quote, company policy was followed regarding the layoffs and lack of severance. 2 months later, some workers have found other jobs. A few transfer to wood grain facilities out of state, but in a town with fewer than 10,000 people, it's a blow.
Devastating. A mainstay of our community was stopped all of a sudden in one day, you know, in just a matter of minutes.
That's Prineville City Manager Steve Forrester. He hopes wood grain will find a way to reopen the entire mill. But if not, other companies have expressed interest in the site.
We know that there has been some on-site visits by what I would call third-party outside interests. We think that's a very good sign.
Either way, it will take time to replace those jobs. According to the state, Crook County's unemployment rate jumped to the highest in Oregon after the layoffs. For workers like Peggy Murphy, the job loss is bigger than a paycheck.
You know, when you start there at 24 years old and you grew up with those people, you know? I mean, got married, had kids, got divorced. Yep.
Not me.
So yeah, it's just different stages of your life right there in that building.
Buchholz recalls the socializing at work.
We all got together at breaks, just whatever, what we did the night before or on the weekend or gossip, yeah.
The women are still in touch almost every day. But Murphy says their conversations are different.
You can't get together unless you call or text message.
What are you texting each other these days?
Do you have a job yet?
Yeah, yeah. How is the job you have?
Of their group of four, two have found jobs. Mary Stanislow is working at Contact Lumber in Prineville as a cutter. It's a job she did years ago.
I mean, I'm grateful to Contact for giving me a job, but it's like I'm starting at the bottom again. It's really hard.
Peggy Murphy found a call center job in Redmond.
I don't want to do it, but you know, you got to have a job, got to work. It's a better wage with better benefits, so I ought to be happier about it. But you know, if it was my choice to have left, then it would have been different.
At the end of the day, they miss their old jobs and each other. Amanda Peacher, reporting.
The Coquille Indian Tribe operates a casino and resort in North Bend on the Oregon coast. Tuesday night, opponents wearing fluorescent yellow t-shirts saying No Medford Casino packed a hearing on the tribe's proposal to build a second gaming facility in South Medford in the Rogue Valley. From Jefferson Public Radio in Ashland, Leah Moriarty reports.
About 300 people crowded into the auditorium at North Medford High School to voice their views to officials from the Federal Bureau of Indian Affairs. The Coquille tribe is asking the government to place a 2.5-acre parcel off Highway 99 into federal trust status, reserving it for the tribe. Coquille Tribal Chair Brenda Mead said support of the request would be the fulfillment of commitments made when Congress restored the tribe's legal status in 1989, several decades after stripping it of federal recognition.
Today, we ask the federal government to uphold its promise to the Coquille people and to consider our trust land application on its merits.
Mead said the casino would provide jobs and economic benefits to the surrounding community as well as the tribe, and she promised the tribe would be a good and generous neighbor. Still, all but a few of the nearly three dozen speakers who gave testimony opposed the application. Prominent among them were members of the Cow Creek Band of the Umpqua tribes. The band operates the Seven Feathers Casino and Resort about an hour's drive north of Medford. Vera Jones, a Cow Creek elder, said competition from a Coquille casino in Medford would be devastating.
The loss of revenue would directly and severely impact services my tribe provides to its members, to our children, and to our elders.
Other speakers warned of increased crime, gambling addiction, and public costs if the casino were built. Elected officials from Jackson County and the city of Medford raised objections as well. The comment period for this stage of the proposal ends on February 17th. I'm Liam Moriarty reporting.
Starting salaries for Idaho teachers are lower than in Washington, Oregon, and three other surrounding states. Superintendents in Idaho's border towns say that's left them with shortages. Idaho lawmakers in both parties want to raise teacher salaries during the legislative session. Jessica Robinson reports on whether they can do enough.
Maybe at one time, a school district like St. Mary's in North Idaho could list a teaching job in the paper, then it would be enough. But Superintendent Joseph Krinn says those days are long gone.
This is the banner that goes across the top.
This is the recruiting kit Krinn takes to job fairs at universities. It's two big plastic bins full of dozens of photos of smiling, well-behaved looking kids and a 12-foot-wide, 8-foot-tall backdrop.
We try to make it as colorful as possible to catch people's eyes.
Krinn says now you've got to be a salesman.
Because you want good quality people. Everybody does. I mean, we're not afraid of it. Hi, I'm Joe Krem, superintendent. You know where St. Mary's is? No, you don't. Oh, let me tell you about us. That type of an approach. You cannot wait for them to come to you.
And sometimes he'll get a bite.
I've had great initial conversations. Then I take out a pay scale. And a lot of times attitudes change.
The salary for a first-year teacher in Idaho is around $31,000. It doesn't help that St. Mary's is only 30 miles from Washington, where the teacher's starting salary is 15% higher and teachers move up the pay scale much faster. One of the largest districts in Idaho, Coeur d'Alene, is across the border from Spokane. Superintendent Matt Handelman says they can attract new teachers. The problem is,
it's more the folks who decide, you know, I've done this for a while, you trained me well, and now I can go sell my wares elsewhere, so to speak.
An experienced Idaho teacher in another district got a $13,000 pay hike moving across the border to Oregon. And it's not just on Idaho's western border. Keith Leppert remembers having a drink one night with some fellow teachers in Idaho Falls. A former colleague who'd taken a job to the east in Wyoming walked into the bar. Leppert says everyone wanted to know, how's it going over there? How are the class sizes?
You could kind of tell as that conversation's going on, everybody's kind of in the back of their mind, you know, is this something that I could do?
A few years later, he did it. Keith Leppert is now a high school math teacher in Buffalo, Wyoming, and he does get paid more, $6,000 or $7,000 more. But Leppert says money was not the big reason he left his Idaho classroom. It was about morale.
It got to the point where teaching was looked on negatively. You know, at the state level, they just didn't care what teachers thought or felt.
In 2012, Idaho went through a bitter campaign over a series of laws the legislature passed aimed at reforming education. They included merit pay, limits on teacher contracts, and a plan that threatened to shift funding from teacher salaries to pay for a laptop for every student in Idaho. Teachers fought it at the ballot box.
And these laws put even more emphasis on teaching to the test.
Vote no on Prop 1.
And they won. Voters overturned the laws. But Coeur d'Alene Superintendent Matt Handelman says with teachers, the image stuck.
From what I've seen, the bigger issue than just pay is how teachers are treated or respected, or at least the perception of that.
Since 2008, two things have happened. The number of teachers coming into Idaho from other states has plummeted, and the number of Idaho teachers leaving the profession altogether has tripled. It's gotten to the point that there's widespread agreement at the Capitol that something has to change. The question is how. Idaho's new schools chief, Sherry Ibarra, held a press conference recently where she discussed her proposals to raise school spending, reduce class sizes, and boost teacher pay.
One thing that's wonderful that's coming out of all these conversations is that we understand that attracting and retaining high-quality teachers is the basis of every one of our discussions.
The chair of a Senate tax committee, a Republican, has threatened to block tax cuts this year unless the state boosts starting teacher pay to $40,000. A career ladder proposal Republican Governor Butch Otter is pushing would do just that, though through a five-year rollout. Many details will have to be worked out through the legislative process, but Joseph Crinn in St. Mary's is optimistic.
If more money is given to those wages, then perhaps we can attract a few more people.
Crinn doesn't know if the money will be enough to change Idaho's reputation, but he's got a heck of a sales pitch for that. I'm Jessica Robinson in Boise.
You're listening to The Bridge on Coast Community Radio. In the weather forecast, rainy and windy today with gusts up to 45 miles per hour, 60 miles per hour near beaches and headlands. Highs will be around 55, nighttime lows in the low 50s. Tomorrow, more wind and rain with gusts again to 45 miles per hour. Daytime highs around 55, lows around 50. The USS Michigan will be the first submarine to allow enlisted women to serve on board. It's part of the Navy's plan to have women doing 20% of the jobs on mixed-gender subs by 2020. The Michigan is an Ohio-class nuclear-powered guided missile submarine stationed at Naval Base Kitsap Bangor. KUOW's Patricia Murphy reports.
The Navy began allowing female officers on subs 3 years ago. Lieutenant Commander Brian Bedora says allowing enlisted women is the next step in the Navy's plan to fully integrate its submarine force. He says senior enlisted women will get on board first to help ensure a smooth transition.
And what they can do is they can kind of go on board, they can kind of find their place, and then what they will be able to do is then mentor the junior enlisted folks that will come on board later on.
The Naval base has 27 female officers stationed there. Practically speaking, there will have to be some modifications on board the Michigan to accommodate more women. That includes creating a 9-space berthing area where female sailors can sleep, and the chief petty officer's quarters will be modified to make a restroom and shower. Women can apply for jobs on the Michigan beginning in April. They're scheduled to come on board by the end of the year. I'm Patricia Murphy reporting.
It's been a tough winter so far for many Cascade Mountain ski resorts. Five in Oregon and Washington have suspended operations until they get more snow. Workers at the summit at Snoqualmie Ski Area in Washington are gathering snow from parking lots and building edges and moving it uphill to keep a few runs open. Nationally, the Pacific Northwest stands out for its low reliance on snowmaking. Correspondent Tom Bonzi reports that may change.
At the White Pass Ski Area west of Yakima, General Manager Kevin McCarthy says he's tempted to hug the snowmaking machines each time he skis by them. His system is relatively small, but he calls the snow guns a lifesaver this year.
I question whether we would have been open much before the 27th of December this year. And at this point in time, I don't know that if we would be open today down here in the base area.
Without the wide white ribbons of man-made snow that lead to the base from the snowy upper mountain, a snow gun looks like a stubby cannon with a big fan on the back. It blows mist out the front that turns to snow before it lands. Temps need to be in the mid-20s or lower for it to work around here. On the slopes beyond the reach of the snow guns, skiers have to navigate around ice sheets, rocks, brown patches. McCarthy says the snowpack today is about 25% of normal. Sadly, that's a common predicament up and down the West Coast this winter. For some resorts, it's the second or third tough year in a row. McCarthy bets this will prompt some rethinking about reliance on natural snow.
Let's look into this. You know, what is the climate going to do for the next 25 years? It has warmed, and it is warming, but thankfully we're able to make snow still, so it's something that I think more and more ski areas will look at.
Snowmaking systems are not new in the ski industry. Ski resorts have relied on snowmaking for decades back east in the Midwest, Rockies, and California. The Northwest has the most holdouts, according to Joe Vanderkillen. He runs one of the country's biggest equipment suppliers, SMI Snowmakers.
And a lot of folks that said, hey, Joe, you're a nice guy, but geez, we'll never have snowmaking at our mountain because, you know, we actually have too much snow, are now circling back, and the bull wheel on the chairlift is circling back.
Vanderkillen says customers may spend as little as $50,000 for a single snow gun and pumping station, all the way up to $50 million at an international resort such as Whistler in British Columbia. Then there's water and where to get it. In southern Oregon, Mount Ashland Ski Area's manager says the lack of a water source rules out snowmaking to augment the snowpack at his oft-closed slopes. The Sun Valley and Mission Ridge resorts were the first in the Northwest to install snowmaking equipment back in the 1970s. John Wax is the current snowmaking manager at Mission Ridge near Wenatchee. He says he still encounters what you might call snow snobbery.
In the Northwest, I think snowmaking a little bit is a dirty word. But I think that as we go through seasons like the last two we've had here in the Northwest, that's beginning to change.
Given the chance, Wax says he explains to skeptics that they wouldn't be sliding right now if it weren't for his handiwork. On the slopes at White Pass, I asked skiers Sharla Summit and Connie Wilkinson for their reviews of the man-made snow.
I haven't noticed a big difference. No. Yeah. Snow, I haven't.
Yeah. I'm all for it. You know, it keeps the lodge open for longer, therefore benefits the skiers.
Snowmaking machines aren't a cure-all. The snow guns are shut down right now because it's too warm for them to work at White Pass, Snoqualmie, and Mission Ridge. I'm Tom Bonsi at White Pass, Washington.
Mark Boma is a Seattle ER nurse who took off to a remote part of Liberia to treat Ebola patients. Boma is back in the Northwest now, and correspondent Anna King has his story of what he accomplished and what he had to leave unfinished.
Mark Boma says the hardest moments of his work on Ebola came early in his tour. He was in Liberia for just a month, and during the first week, he was stationed in the capital city of Monrovia. That's when a young boy, his sister, and mother were all taken into the health center, stricken with Ebola.
And the brother died overnight, and the little girl was like sleeping next to this dead Ebola patient that was her brother and was there and witnessed it.
His coworker named Heather came and found them that way. The mother appeared resigned and very sick, and the sister was in shock over her brother's death. It was Boma's job then to take Heather's account of what had happened at the end of the day. Boma learned later that both the mother and daughter had perished from Ebola too. He calls that moment emotionally challenging, but not in a way that makes him feel hopeless.
And kind of validated why we were there and what we were doing.
He felt needed. After a week in Monrovia, Boma was sent with another aid worker to the remote village of Zouedru. They were escorted there by the U.S. Marine Corps. A small excerpt from his audio journal describes his flight there.
I'm hanging out the back of a V-22 Osprey, a Boeing-built plane that takes off like a helicopter and flies by like a plane. As the Osprey banks and dodges between mountains and jungle-filled ravines, I think to myself, how did I get here?
Boma's been doing this kind of disaster work around the world for a while. He's been to Tacloban in the Philippines and Port-au-Prince, Haiti. His first trip was to Nicaragua in 2008, right before he finalized his divorce.
It was kind of a way to kind of reinvent myself and kind of find myself and find my place in the world.
Boma says a lot of the aid workers he's traveled with are searching for something too, or are untethered to home and family. When they come back, it can be hard to relate. Even when people ask about what he's seen, Boma isn't sure what to say.
They don't really want to know about all the poverty and all the horrible things you saw. They really just kind of asking you kind of that polite social, oh, you were gone for a month in Africa. How is that?
So he gives a cleaned up version. He talks about things that aren't so grim, even in his audio diary.
In my suitcase I carried to Liberia, there were 9 pounds of Starbucks via instant coffee. It's really the only thing that's keeping me going here.
Boma had a vision for his trip that was different than what actually happened. He thought he would be working directly with Ebola patients. He volunteered for this tour just when Ebola was exploding in Liberia. Instead, he was sent to work managing the construction of a 20-building Ebola treatment unit. It was being hacked right out of the jungle. Boma says he and his co-workers' main tasks were fixing problems. They had to make sure it got built, order supplies, and hire staff and nurses for this new facility. In just 12 grueling weeks, they had built up the Ebola treatment center, and Boma had managed the hiring and training of 100 local nurses and technicians. He helped plan the opening ceremony. But the end of his tour in Zouedru was the day before the event. He didn't get to see the ribbon cutting.
Not being able to see that continue and grow is challenging because, you know, you work so hard. We were working 18-hour days almost every day. And kind of all that work and then just kind of leave it behind and not get to see it continue to function is challenging, but it's kind of part of the deal.
Now, Boma says his work in Africa is still incomplete. He's planning to embark on another nonprofit nursing tour in late March. He's headed to a refugee camp in Uganda. I'm Anna King reporting.
And now for the saga of the car ferry Kalakala. The streamlined Art Deco vessel that for years was as much of a symbol of Seattle as the Space Needle, and really the Kalakala, which supposedly means bird in the Chinook language, symbolized Seattle before there was a Space Needle. She plied the waters of Puget Sound from 1935 until her retirement in 1967. In fact, she was voted second only to the Space Needle in popularity among visitors to Seattle during the 1962 Seattle World's Fair. After her retirement in 1967, the Kalakala was sold to a seafood processing company and towed to Alaska to work as a factory ship. Then, after a period spent working as a crabbing ship in Alaska, the Kalakala was beached in Kodiak in 1970 and used to process shrimp. Investor Peter Bevis discovered her on a fishing trip in 1984. By that time, she had been turned into a cannery. After years of financial negotiations, Bevis refloated her and had her towed back to Seattle in 1998 with the idea of refurbishing her to her former glory. That never happened. And in 2004, she was sold to another investor who moved her to an anchorage in Nia Bay, Washington, provided by the Macaw tribe. But not long after she arrived at Nia Bay, she was evicted by the Macaw, who also brought a lawsuit against her owners. The next stop, Tacoma. Fast forward to February 2008. New Kalakala owner Steve Rodriguez announced his intention to acquire additional vintage ferry vessels and to restore them and the Kalakala as either ferries powered by wind and solar technologies or as museums. The Kalakala was scheduled for work on her hull and superstructure in dry dock in 2010, but it never happened. And not only that, after having spent 6 years in Tacoma, she began to list, and officials worried that she might pose an environmental hazard. Rodriguez was also pressured to take action after Washington State passed a law focusing on the removal of abandoned or neglected vessels. At length, Rodriguez put her up for sale for $1, contingent on the purchaser committing to renovate her. That was in 2010. In December 2011, the Coast Guard declared her a hazard to navigation and set a December 19, 2011 deadline for Rodriguez to repair her hull and submit a plan to tow her away from her mooring in Tacoma. This deadline was never met. Rodriguez appealed the order and claimed an unnamed person had purchased her. The Coast Guard rejected the appeal on the basis that there was no evidence any work had been done on her or evidence that there was any sort of sale. The situation dragged on, and in July 2012, Rodriguez sued the state of Washington, claiming that the state had failed in its duty to help preserve the ferry. His suit asked that the state be prevented from forcing the Kalakala to be moved, confiscated, or sunk, and sought to force the state to pay about $50 million to restore her under a proposal he had previously submitted. That was rejected. Finally, in November 2012, Carl Anderson, owner of the Hylabus Waterway Uplands, where the Kalakala was moored, took possession of her in exchange for the $4,000 he claimed Rodriguez owed him in back rent. That was in November 2012. Finally, on January 4th of this year, Anderson announced that the Kalakala would be scrapped. and that set the stage for the Kalakala's last voyage. As described on the website kalakala.org, early on the morning of January 22nd, the Kalakala was slowly towed to a graving dock in Tacoma's Blair Waterway. The tow went by the numbers, and she made it to the dock without any glitches. The graving dock doors were installed, and the water slowly let out. Reverend Dr. Francis Lorenz of Tacoma Center for Spiritual Living performed a blessing and offered her owner Carl Anderson 4 symbolic feathers. Everyone in attendance was offered a white feather to toss into the receding water. As the water receded from the graving dock, the Kalakala hit bottom. Everybody expected that she would list and rest completely on her side, but the Kalakala never did what was expected of her. No, she decided to die with dignity. As her hull hit the bottom of the graving dock, her flat bottom kept her upright and proud. A pair of excavators tried to push her on her side to try and get her over, but she wasn't having it. So, as she's dismantled, she'll remain upright and go out the same way she came into this world. And so ends an era. Thank you to Kalakala.org, the official website of the MV Kalakala, the Tacoma News Tribune, and Wikipedia, the People's Online Encyclopedia, for their contributions to this story. And that's all the time we have for this morning. I'm David Paul, reminding you to tune in again next Thursday morning for another edition of The Bridge.